Good evening, everyone. How scared is everyone? Pretty much. Me too. My name is Matt Murphy. I'm the general manager of WERU Community Radio, and I'm real happy to see you all and thank you all for coming out tonight. We've got quite a great evening for you, some really great storytellers, and I hope you enjoy it very much. I'm here to introduce Bucksport's own Paula Key, but before that, let's hear for Paula. The queen of Wednesday on Main, who does an awful lot for Bucksport. So now I'm going to do the drawing. This is the fabled watering can that we, during pledge drives at WERU, put everyone's name in at the end of each show and do a drawing for a CD. And so this is the watering can that we speak of on the air. So I'm going to reach in. The winner is going to get this hat. And the winner is Sarah Moffitt. Okay, all right, I'll catch her out in the lobby. And now, folks, here's Paula Key.
Thank you, Matt. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. Well, as you can see, we have a little story that's going to be told about Bucksport, so I'm going to get to that in a moment. But this is our last Wednesday on Main evening for the season, and I have a few people to thank. First of all, you, for coming and supporting and donating every week, every month. It's been a wonderful season, and we couldn't do it without you. And we also couldn't do it without Darlings of Augusta, Bangor, and Ellsworth, the town of Bucksport, Bangor Savings Bank, Camden National Bank, our sponsors of events. We've had a few individual events completely sponsored by local folks, and we are very grateful. And we also want to thank Kathy James, who owns the Lighthouse Arts Center. She's a great support and a wonderful venue. If you haven't been there, hurry, hurry, go. And we've got lots of volunteers. I have to mention David Key first because, you know, he's like married to me. And so thank you, David Key. And David Weida, who provides wonderful shortbread for every single Wednesday on Main events. There's 18 events we've had this year. And he also has Bucksport's only bed and breakfast, Williams Pond Lodge, which is kind of off the grid and kind of gorgeous. So if you haven't been there, be sure to go. I also need, yes? What?
I need to come back and see if Sarah came back into the auditorium. There you are.
Right. There she is.
And while I'm here, can we hear it for Amy Brown, our News and Public Affairs Manager, and Susan Pierce, our Office and Volunteer Coordinator, and Phil Yates on sound running the show. Thanks to all them who did so much work to make this happen.
Absolutely. Thank you, Matt. And I've just a few more people to thank. Bob Alley, who's the chairman of my series. That means he moves the chairs when we're outside. Karen Johnson, the Lalonds, so many more people in the community have supported us every week. And we certainly love to partner with WERU Radio. This is our fourth or fifth time doing these wonderful events. And they're my co-pro for the music documentary film series every year. So we love them, and we know you love them too. Obviously, you're here. And we'll be sharing the donations that we collect tonight with WERU. We're going 50-50, so thank you for supporting them. And the next thing I want to tell you, I've got a quick little story to read. And back in June of 2017, I had Mel Allen come to speak to Bucksport through the Wednesday on Main program on the power of community, because we were certainly getting our engines revved up to get powered up and turn this town into something that we've never been before. So Mel came. It was a beautiful summer day, and he fell in love with Bucksport, and so much so that he decided he was going to write the story of Bucksport's transition from Milltown to Newtown, whatever we are. And the story's going to be in next month's issue of Yankee Magazine, which will be coming out at the end of this month. This is the front page of the story. It's a 15-page story, and the photos were by Gabe Souza, who is a Bucksport native who's gone on to be quite successful and quite famous. So I asked Mel if he could be here tonight. He could not. He could not get a video because his tech guy had a broken leg or something. So he's written just a little narrative about how it was for him when he came to Bucksport and what made him decide to write the story. And so if you'll bear with me, I'm going to be reading his story, and it's brief, so here we go. And this is all from Mel, written on October the 18th. I want to thank everyone here this evening at the Alamo for making time for me to say a few words, via Paula Key, about my feature on Bucksport in the new issue of Yankee Magazine. The boxes of magazines just arrived from the printer today, and it has never grown old for me, opening those boxes and turning the pages. The cover of the new issue says Making Merry, and it has a decided holiday feel. The cover photo is taken from a cookie swap, and the cover line about your town, that's our town, reads, A Season of Hope in Bucksport, Maine. I know Bookstacks ordered a lot of issues, and I believe Hannaford's will also have them on display, usually by the last day in October. I hope you get a copy. We titled the story, The Town That Refused to Die, because above all else, that was the feeling I brought home with me after my days in your town. This is how the story begins, and this is a quote from the story. You learn what you're made of, not when life is good, but when the ground beneath your feet gives way, and you are left afraid and uncertain of what to do. In the past year, I found the same may be said about a town. The one I'm talking about is Bucksport, Maine. So many things go into writing a lengthy story. This one ended up at about 6,000 words, and along with the photography by native son Gabe Souza, it spreads across 15 pages, one of our two longest stories this year. And here's the thing, I wish I'd been able to write at least another 2,000 words. I met so many people in Bucksport, there were so many fine interviews, so many stories I could have told. This story became one of the most challenging I've done in my nearly 40 years at Yankee because I had to leave out so many voices. From the first time Paula Key contacted me to speak at Wednesdays on Maine in early summer of 2017, I did a little background research and knew there was a story emerging here. What I did not know at first, however, was how each personal story entwined with another. How one person's memories joined those of others. I've told many people this. I wish I could have visited Bucksport for several days each month from the time the mill was closed and so many in town joined by the gate to greet the last shift and kept visiting until now, when you were on the cusp of seeing a major new industry develop at Salmon Point. I believe that would have been a book. There's always a danger in acknowledging the help of people who made time for interviews because invariably my memory may falter and someone is left out, so I apologize in advance. But just to give everyone a sense of how a long-form narrative takes shape, here are some of the people in town without whom I could have not written the story. Richard and Kim Rosen, Paula and David Key, Mike and Colleen Gross, Tom Gaffney, Nancy Minot, and the Heart and Soul Volunteers, who welcomed me to a meeting, Susan Lessard, David Keene, Dan Wentworth, Gabe Souza, Don Houghton, both for his interview and for the many weekly issues of the Enterprise, which kept me up to date on all happenings, Pat and Ed Ranzoni, Jeff McGlynn, Jane Donnell, Mike Carrier, Andy Locker, Catherine James at Lighthouse Arts Center, Brooke Minner, Leslie Wambacher, Frank Dunbar, Sam Russell, who made the film Paper Town, which you all saw here, Rob Piazio of Whole Oceans, and as I said, I'm sure I left someone off. I had compiled over 30,000 typed words of notes, and that doesn't include many of the articles read from the Boston Globe, the Ellsworth American, the Bangor Daily News, and of course, the Enterprise. And most importantly, what I learned from reading and then rereading The Magnificent Still Mill, a book I am certain will be read by generations for the humanity that lives inside the covers. I also want to thank everyone who took time to meet with photographer Gabe Souza. I wish we had more pages to show what he had captured, not only the portraits, but scenes of Bucksport life that most casual observers never see. I had so many difficult decisions on what to put in and what to leave out. Just to give an example, for the longest time, I was certain that the structure of the story would revolve around the workers leaving on the last shift and the people who were there to greet them, and the stories would intersect. That became too unwieldy for a single magazine story. It would have been a nifty way to have done a book. I was also certain, and I mean totally certain, that the story would end with a dramatic home run by Madison Robichaux when the Lady Bucks were down to the final out. I felt that moment encapsulated the spirit of Bucksport, coached by a decades-long papermaker, an improbable win snatched from certain defeat. It felt like the perfect metaphor for a town that refused to give in, refused to accept defeat. And here's why writing can turn out to be an unpredictable endeavor. I simply could not make that last scene fit with the arc of the story. It required enough background to set it up, and by then I'd used my space. But just for the record, I still think that Maddie's home run is the perfect metaphor for how so many of you, I imagine many here tonight, did not accept that having two strikes, two outs, down a run, meant you needed to concede. No writer's ever satisfied with the story, but it was the best I could do at the time. I have so much respect for your town, and I hope the story reflects it. Thank you, Mel Allen. He's a good guy. He really loves Bucksport. So make sure you get your copy of the magazine, and now I'm going to bring Amy Brown up and let her get this fun night started. Thank you.
It's okay. Thanks, Paula. And between Paula and Matt, I think they thanked everybody that I was going to thank, except all of you. Thanks for coming out. We have seven storytellers, and they are each going to tell a brief story, maybe 10 minutes maximum. And our first one tonight is Anu Dudley. Anu is a semi-retired history professor from the University of Maine at Orono, and she's helped put on the Common Ground Fair for the past 34 years. She also may be familiar to some of you who listen to WERU from her short feature that she's produced there for several years now called Earthwise. It's on Saturday mornings at 7:30, and she lives in the woods off the grid in Freedom, Maine. Anu, come on up. You are first up on deck. I'm going to go turn on the recorder over here.
Which one of these am I talking into? This one? Okay, good, good. Well, I'm glad that I'm first because I get a chance to ask everybody, how many of you out there believe in ghosts? Oh, good, almost all of you, that's good. Well, and here's another question. How many of you have actually seen a ghost? All right, oh, about four, okay. Well, that's fine. Well, all of you have wonderful stories to tell, so I encourage you to develop those. But what I want to do tonight is to tell you one of my personal stories, a true story, about one of my experiences with ghosts. The story takes place in Bangor, and it was several years ago. At that point, I was teaching at the university, and I was teaching on a Tuesday-Thursday rotation, and I was also doing a research project at the Maine Folklife Center on campus. So I was, in fact, up in Orono 3 days a week, and a friend and colleague of mine had said, well, why don't you just stay at my house in Bangor? Then you won't have to drive back and forth. And I thought that was a really generous offer. And so that's how I came to be spending Tuesday and Wednesday nights each week during the semester up at my friend's house in Bangor, where this story takes place. Now, she is a cat person. She's a cat lady, classic cat lady, and she has two cats. She always has at least two cats. And so there were two cats living in the house at the time. And that was fine with me. I mean, I like cats. Cats like me. In fact, I've had three cats in my life. I mean, I'm a dog person, but I've actually had three cats. And the first cat I ever had came with a house that my husband and I were renting in Texas. This was a very old cat. She was 16, and she was blind. And the owners of the house said, don't worry, we'll take her and have her put down because we know you probably don't want to have to take care of an old blind cat. And my husband and my six-year-old son at the time said, oh, no, don't do that. We'll take care of her, which, of course, meant I would take care of her. And I was a little upset about that because I just had another newborn baby at the time, and it sounded like it was going to be a lot of work. But in fact, unaccountably, this old cat attached herself to me immediately. She would follow me around the house, and she would sit down on the floor by me, and she would purr. In fact, she even let me cut her claws because she was too old to scratch on things, and so her claws were growing into her paws, so I had to trim her claws, and she even let me do that. I thought that was amazing. In fact, we called called her Amazing Gracie, and she survived three more moves with us while we came back up to New England and finally died at the age of 22. She was incredible. Well, that's just a sidetrack, just to let you know that I have cat cred. Okay? I mean, cats like me, apparently, and I like them, so I get along with them. Now, the problem that I was having, however, is that I'm also a very light sleeper. And the very first night that I stayed at my friend's house, I was awoken by a cat jumping on my bed. And that was, you know, a little annoying, so I had to turn the light on and look around and find the cat and get it out of the room and then close the door. So then I decided, well, I'm always going to close the door from now on. So the next night, I turned the light out and went to sleep, and I was once again awoken by a cat jumping on my bed. And I thought, this is odd. I've closed the door. So I turned the light on. I looked all around the room, under the bed, under the furniture. I even looked in the closet, although the closet door was closed, and I couldn't find any cat. So I didn't know what was going on, but this went on for a couple of weeks, and it was starting to get really creepy. I mean, I'd feel this cat jumping on the bed and then walking around, then even leaning up against my leg. So one day I mentioned it to my friend, and she said, "Oh, that's probably old Lauren." And I said, "Who or what is Lauren?" Well, it turns out that she, too, had inherited a cat when she bought this house in Bangor. He was an old cat at the time, and the owner of the house said, "Don't worry, I'll just have the cat put down because I can't take it with me, and he's really old anyway." And she said, "Oh, no, don't do that. I'll take care of him." But it was a big mistake for her to do that. She didn't have the nice experience I had. For almost immediately, old Lauren started attacking her cats. There was a big cat fight going on all the time. And worse, Lauren started marking his territory. And you know what that means with a cat. He started peeing all over the house. And it was really unpleasant. And so she finally just said, "I can't take this anymore." And so very reluctantly, she said, "I'm going to have to take this cat to the vet and have it put down." So that was the end of Lauren. And you have to understand that my friend categorically does not believe in ghosts. And so when she said, "Oh, that's just probably Lauren," she was making a joke. But I, who believe in ghosts, thought that was a really good explanation for what was going on. That what was actually happening was this ghost cat was jumping up on my bed every night when I was there and walking around, finding just the right place, and then leaning up against me. And so, you know, I thought, well, that was a little endearing. Maybe I can make friends with Lauren. So the first thing I did was I made a nice comfy bed and put it way on the other side of the room, far away from my bed. You know, and I said, "Now be a good kitty and you sleep over there and I'll sleep over here." And well, you can imagine how that worked out, right? So that night the cat jumps up on my bed. And so the next night I said, "Okay, you know, maybe it takes a little more encouragement. Maybe Lauren would like some catnip and maybe a nice little dish of water or milk." So I did that. And the next night, you know, I laid all that stuff out and I said, "Now be a good kitty and just enjoy these little treats." And I turned the light out and went to sleep. And of course, Lauren jumped up on the bed and started walking around. He woke me up. And then I thought, you know what? I am a dog person. And I have a dog blanket at home that really smells like dog. So I'm going to bring that in next time, and I'm going to lay it over my bed. And that way, when Lauren jumps up, he'll smell the dog and he'll run away. Because, you know, cats and dogs, they don't mix. So I said, that's being really clever. So I laid it out next time, and I put it on my bed. And I said, "Ha, now you'll be a good kitty tonight, Lauren." And then I turned out the light and went to sleep. And, well, you guessed it. He woke me up jumping on the bed, and there was just nothing I could do, you know? This went from being creepy to being just plain annoying. But then I thought, well, why did I think this would work? I mean, it's hard enough to get a living cat to do what you want it to do, right? So why did I think that I could get a ghost cat to do what I wanted to do? So I thought, you know, I'm going to have to get serious. I am going to have to perform an exorcism. But, I mean, not really an exorcism, because, you know, an exorcism is when you want to get rid of the devil, right? And, I mean, Lauren wasn't the devil. In fact, Lauren was not even a bad kitty. I mean, he was just a cranky old ghost cat who was stuck. He hadn't been able to find his way over to the next world, and so he needed some help. So I thought, what can I do about that? I guess I'm just going to create a nice, gentle, energetic vortex that will give him a portal to pass through and find his highest good elsewhere. Now, I don't have time tonight to tell you all the details of the ceremony that I did, but I will point out a few things. One is that the best time to do a ceremony like this, of course, is in a waning moon, and I knew that I had about a week and a half before the moon shifted to its waning phase, so I had enough time to collect what I needed to collect to do the ceremony. And what I did was I found this big, purple cloth that would make a good bedspread. It had black velvet stars and half moons on it. I thought it looked appropriately magical for a bedspread. I still had some time growing in my garden, and so I collected it and made a wreath. And I found a maple stick in my yard, and I shaped it into a wand. I collected my ceremonial broom and a dish of salt. And I was all ready, so on the appointed night, I got ready to do this ceremony. First, I took my broom, and I swept the room to sort of break up all of that stuck energy that was holding Lauren there. And then I walked in the Widdersons' direction, which is, you know, anti-clockwise, and I sprinkled salt around the room just to purify the atmosphere. And then I laid the bedspread over the bed to protect it. And I took the thyme wreath and I put it under the bed just for some extra protection and purification. And then I picked up my maple wand and I turned in the direction of the west and I began to cut a portal in the air, very slowly and gracefully, a large portal. And I put a shining gold rim around the edge of it so that it would be very easy to see. And the portal itself was filled with a beautiful, glowing, rosy, pink, gold light. Very soothing and attractive. And I said, Lauren, here's your portal. And it's time for you to leap through this portal. And suddenly, over my right shoulder, leapt this big, white cat with a big gray spot on its head and a big gray spot on its back and had a long white tail. And it leapt over my shoulder and through the portal and disappeared. And then I closed up the portal. The room felt energized and fresh. And I said, well, we're going to see tonight if he's really gone. But then as I was getting ready for bed, I thought to myself, you know, I never asked my friend what Lauren looked like. I don't know what kind of a cat he was. But who knows, there was something that leapt through that portal. So I went to bed and I slept all night. Nothing woke me up. And the same thing happened the next night. And so I finally, the following week, I told my friend what had happened, and I said, you know, I never asked you what Lauren looks like. What kind of a cat was he? And she said, you know, he was a big, fat, white cat. And he had a gray patch on his head, another big gray patch on his back, and he had a long white tail. And I thought, huh, so that was Lauren after all. Leaping through the portal to find his highest good elsewhere. Good kitty. Thank you.
Thanks, Anu. Todd Nelson is up next, and we have a blend tonight. Some of you have been probably to our other storytelling events. We've been doing them here in partnership with Wednesday on Main for 4 years now, sometimes more than once a year. And so some of the folks you're going to hear from tonight are our regulars, and some folks are new to our stage. Todd is one of the folks that's new to our stage, but you may have heard his short features that are airing on Bookworm, which is Brooke Minner's show once a month on WERU. Todd's a retired English teacher and school principal at several local schools and schools elsewhere. He lives in Penobscot with his wife, Leslie, and considers himself a full-time writer. And I'm going to read his setup to this story. When Todd was 17, during the summer between his junior and senior year in high school, 1973, he went to Somerset, England to work in the Rumbling Tum restaurant in Chelten Polden. I hope I pronounced that correctly. It was his summer job and a return to the countryside he had traveled in previous summers. This is Thomas Hardy country, farmland, in an area with an accent you might mistake for a down east accent. And the Rumbling Tum was a 200-year-old restaurant being run by a retired London fireman who had inherited it from his aunt. And it was haunted by two ghosts identified by the locals. And Todd's accommodations for the summer were the most haunted bedroom above the dining room. So here's Todd Nelson. I know, I'm so scared. The only thing scarier than tonight would be to stay home and watch CNN.
Thanks, through that. You'll see.
Another turn of the screw. This is a true story. I have contemporaneous notes. In my younger and more vulnerable years, the summer of 1973 to be precise, I worked as a waiter at a small restaurant in Somerset, England. It was in the village of Chilton Polden on the edge of Sedgemoor, the site of the last battle fought on English soil during the Monmouth Rebellion in 1685. No, Culloden does not count. It was a rout. 500 defeated rebels were taken to London and executed by the army of King James II. Many of the Duke of Monmouth's supporters were then tried during the bloody assizes. Many were transported abroad, others executed by drawing and quartering. Monmouth himself was taken to the Tower of London. There, after several blows of the axe, he was successfully beheaded. Fun fact, drawing and quartering was specifically reserved for the crime of high treason and was on the books in England until 1870. I digress. In 1973, I had finished my junior year in high school and wanted to return to the landscape of a prior summer adventure when I rode my bicycle from London to Land's End and back. And I wanted to have an unusual summer job. I did not anticipate paranormal encounters. John Mancy, the proprietor of the Rumbling Tum restaurant, took a chance on this 17-year-old Yank. "We would be pleased to accept you as one of our staff from July 5th until the end of August. We're only a very small restaurant. There would be no charge for accommodation. You would live as one of the family. The wage is £6 per week plus tips, which can vary considerably. You'll find us quite ordinary, not particularly rich, but all very happy together. There are two other young men who live in, Tony and Malcolm. Every Thursday night is disco night." I accepted. Then my work permit was denied. John wrote again. "If you would like to come over and spend your vacation with us, there's nothing to stop you from having a holiday. Naturally, we would like you to be our guest. Just make clear to anyone that's interested that you are on holiday visiting friends." John wouldn't waste postage. "While I'm writing, I'd better tell you a bit about our place," he continued. "The restaurant was originally built well over 350 years ago. It has low doorways and uneven flooring, but a great deal of old-world charm. And then, it's haunted by two ghosts, one of which was seen by a customer only last Saturday. Still, they're quite harmless and don't bother us too much. I find them quite pleasant. I never believed in them until I came to live here 5 years ago. I do believe now. To summarize, I would be a 17-year-old American working illegally, being paid a pittance under the table by people I'd never met, staying in their doubly haunted home. Confirmed. Don't forget disco night. I was undeterred. I arrived on July 5th, the day before the 288th anniversary of the battle massacre of Sedgemoor, which the Rumbling Tum Cottage predated by 62 years. When I arrived, John met me at the train station in Bridgewater and drove the 10 miles out to Chilton Polden, a delightful little village of stone cottages. He was amiable, witty, welcoming, and the Somerset countryside was entirely beguiling. Rolling wheat fields, high, lush hedgerows, a first cutting of hay in progress, just the setting for romances and stories. This would be fun. John was a retired London fireman, World War II veteran, big band musician, and reformatory teacher. He inherited the Rumbling Tum from his aunt and turned it into a modestly thriving restaurant. He was a self-taught cook. Local lad Tony was learning the trade from John. Lazy Malcolm was the other waiter. I would serve lunch and dinner each day with Sundays off. The job was a pleasure. The locals were amused by my accent. I was confounded by theirs. The mortician from the local hospital was a regular, as were Mr. and Mrs. Go-to-Bed, Irish motorway construction workers, and young farmers at disco night. On my days off, I roamed the countryside, the fields and lanes of the Mendip Hills, and that battlefield. Did I mention there are two ghosts? John said over dinner one night. Both inhabited the house at some point. Plenty of people have seen them. He described his firsthand experiences. One ghost is an older gentleman. He's been identified by Mr. Trafford from next door, who knew him. Apparently, he died in Bristol during an air raid in the Second War. Interesting. Ghost provenance. Noted. I was right here in the kitchen working at the stove one day, John said, pointing, when this old gentleman came up behind me and pushed my elbow. I felt it for sure. As I turned around, he vanished. Okay, so you can feel a ghost. Noted. I now knew what to look for. This geezer would not be sneaking up on me. My journal entry for July 10th. I notice that I'm tending to look over my shoulder or around corners a lot. Actually, I peered around every corner before entering or leaving a room. Consider the collateral issues, like going to the bathroom while keeping an eye out for ghosts. Number two, soaking in the bathtub. Being alone in the house, as I was every Saturday night, looking out my bedroom window on Sedgemoor's morning mist and thinking of the souls of the Monmouth slain, drawn and quartered. Oh, the wind did some howl across that moor. I think it was the wind. One day, John said, my father was sleeping upstairs once and had someone climb into bed with him. He lay very still. He didn't see who it was. But the door to the room was closed tight. That's your bedroom. Noted. Then one night, I woke up suddenly. I thought I saw someone standing over my bed. After a very long moment, I realized I had just left the wardrobe door open and a white shirt hanging on the knob. New rules. Put all clothes away before bedtime. Ghost number two was a woman. She seems to be from another era, based on her hair and dress, John said. She appears in the barroom and just stands there with her head tilted and her hand on one side of her cheek, looking thoughtful. She wears her hair in a bun. Her dress is cream-colored. A pensive ghost, noted. And then there were the stories about the inexplicable sounds, the little bell that sits on the mantle of the bar that can be heard tinkling in the morning when no one is in the room. Common for people staying in my room to hear it, apparently. The ladies won't even go upstairs, John told me, no matter how much they need to use the loo. Then there were the things observed by a whole dining room full of people. For instance, brass plates levitating off the wall, crossing the room, slamming against the opposite wall. Check, please. Most sightings happened around February. But one Halloween, they held a séance. This elicited a loud crash in the upstairs bedroom, the vacant upstairs bedroom. John's aunt was a medium. She thought he was more psychic than she. Everyone has a guardian spirit, she told him. His was a very tall man dressed in a dark coat, who his aunt once saw standing over the bed where John was extremely ill. Terrific. My host and employer is a paranormal lightning rod. Tony said he didn't believe in them. However, John once returned home to find Tony sitting in a corner with the dog close beside him and all the doors open. And then there's the bread incident. Tony and John were sitting opposite one another at the kitchen table, a loaf of bread between them. It rose into the air off the table. The bread levitated and went back down again. My journal entry for July 15th. One starts overthinking, especially when alone in a room, as I am now. And it can really set off a lot of reactions that are out of proportion and cause a lot of unnecessary fear of spookedness. I almost wish I hadn't learned all I did today about these ghosts. The stories did make for good tableside chit-chat. Many customers demanded to hear the tales. I became expert in telling them, with a straight face, without elaboration. The facts needed no embellishment. Since I wrote everything down in my daily journal, even now, all these years later, I am certain of all that I saw and heard. Yes, my bedroom was the most haunted room in the house. I adapted my routine. When I turned in for the night, I made certain that I left nothing lying about haphazardly. No white waiter's shirt draped over the chair to terrify me in the middle of the night. The door had to be shut tight. No good having the restaurant cat pushing in and giving me fits. Thus, I slept well. One night a week, I was the only one home. Tony went night fishing. John volunteered at the local hospital. No problem. The 30th of August finally came. my final night. John and Tony gave me a good send-off. I still have the photos of empty pint glasses lined up on the bar. Did the poltergeists, Jane and Jerry, as they came to be called, know of my imminent departure? Would it matter? Would they feel compelled to bid me a paranormal adieu? I climbed the steep steps to my bedroom for the last time. I stowed my white shirt in a drawer, closed the room door tight. I slipped into bed. I pulled the covers up around my chin. I listened to the midnight sounds of the house, the dark silence, the nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. And then I slept. Today, the Rumbling Tum is known as the Olive Mill. It has 3 stars, an extensive wine list, expanded parking, an outdoor dining terrace. Thursday is now pizza and Prosecco night. Friendly service and a great menu which focuses on hearty modern British cuisine. And they now have guest accommodations. The rooms are tastefully decorated and furnished and come with all the facilities you would expect to find in a hotel. Ensuite bathrooms, tea and coffee making facilities, televisions, and complimentary Wi-Fi. The bedrooms are, of course, upstairs. Noted. Thank you.
Thanks, Todd. Our next storyteller is someone who was one of the original storytellers in the series. You can start heading up this way. This is Naomi Gray Chase, who is famous for her poop and bubbles story from the original storytelling. That's still available in our archives if you've missed it. Naomi is a local writer, firefighter, and yoga teacher. She happens to be an empathic, telepathic, and psychic medium / intuitive. She lives in Bucksport in a home that she is sure is not haunted, but just up the road from one that she knows for certain is. Her story is about the first ghost that she ever saw. It happened on a dark, cold night in Bucksport, 1975. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for coming out tonight. Thanks, Amy. It turns out it was 1974, not 1975. I did a little fact-checking. So my young parents in 1974 and I were living in Tucson, Arizona, but it wasn't working out. So my parents packed up all of their worldly possessions and put them into a rickety trailer, which they hitched behind a rickety old car, and drove straight through from Tucson back to Bucksport, where we are from. And arrived exhausted in the middle of the night, a cold, dark winter's night, pulled up in front of a friend's house right here in Bucksport on the Tannery Stream. Everybody was so tired from this long drive that my parents, who had just turned 21, and I, who was about two and a half, went straight upstairs to the second floor bedroom. It was a sparse bedroom. It was pretty cold in there. There was a bed and a dresser, and the only light in the room was a single naked bulb hanging from the ceiling. And it just had a little metal chain on it that you could pull to turn it on and off. But it was so high up in the room that my dad was the only one who could reach it, so he turned the light off, and we all got in bed, me between my parents. My dad and I fell asleep right away. But my mom was feeling kind of uneasy, so it took her longer to drift off. But eventually, the exhaustion won, and she fell asleep. But she woke up a short time later to find that the light in the room was on. My dad was still sound asleep next to her, the only person that could have turned it on. And I was standing in the middle of the bed, 2 years old, blonde hair, reaching up towards the light, arms wide open, saying, take me, take me, take me. My mom snatched me back, woke up my dad. I don't think they slept for the rest of the night, and they left and stayed somewhere else starting in the morning. Within 6 months, a series of mysterious catastrophic accidents began to befall my tiny self. In the next place that we lived, a dresser tipped over and snapped my femur in half. It's the strongest bone in your body. 3 years old, snapped my femur. I spent 6 months in a body cast. Got out of the body cast. We moved to a one-room cabin. My dad decided to give me a sandbox. So we got a half ton of sand, put it in a trailer, and neither of my parents know how this happened, but I wound up underneath the trailer. Half ton of sand crushed my ankle, tiny little 4-year-old ankle. I recovered. We moved into a cellar on the Upper Falls Road. I had a little brother by then, and he and I were playing a game with a ball in a back bedroom that still wasn't finished, and there was a 2x4 in a closet with a nail sticking out of it. I dove for the ball and drove the nail into my eye, completely sank it into my eye. I went to kindergarten with an eye patch. Yeah. So one day, after I got the eye patch off, I was at home in our cellar on the Upper Falls Road in Orland. There's a blueberry field that abuts the property. And I was alone. I'm sure there were grown-ups around, but it was a moment of solitude for me. What I remember is no grown-ups and being within myself. And I felt this very warm feeling in the center of my body. And I felt absolutely certain that I had to get outside. So I went outside, and I began to have this sensation that my body was full of something that wasn't me. So I still knew my name. I hadn't gone away, but I could feel that the inside of me didn't belong completely to me anymore. And I knew that I needed to get up as high as I could, and that I needed to open my arms up to the light above me. So I climbed up onto a boulder, and I stood on the boulder, and I opened my arms up wide, and I looked up at the sky. And that feeling inside of me, it was like energy but solid inside my body. And I was having the experience of feeling it, but at the same time being sort of watching it, right, from a distance. And what it felt like was music. It felt like song made solid, if you can understand how that might have felt. And it needed to push its way out of my body. So I stood on my rock, 5 years old, arms held open wide, looking up at the sky, and I started to sing, full voice, right from my heart. This song moved itself out of my body. It was not a song that I had heard on the radio or on a record. It was not a song that somebody had taught me. And it was this song all about love and loss. It was about lamenting and living, dreaming and growing and crying and being. It was like if you could distill the essence of life and life lost, this was the story that came out of myself standing on the boulder next to the blueberry field singing. When the song ended, my body felt empty again and normal. My arms went back down to my sides. I climbed off the rough boulder, went back into the house, and carried on with my 5-year-old day. I never again had a significant mysterious accident. I made it after having a serious accident every 6 months from that moment with the light in the cottage next to Tannery Stream. I never broke another bone, and I never had another major illness or catastrophe all through my whole childhood. I moved back to Bucksport about 10 years ago, late in my 30s, and I started driving past that house because my house is quite nearby to it. It's about 3/4 of a mile, and it's on my route when I go places. And one of the things that I've noticed is that every time I drive past it, I feel a feeling in my body. Now, over the course of this time, these 10 years, I also discovered that I know how to see and listen and talk to beings who have departed. So I can handle it a little better than I could when I was 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. And so I thought maybe I should go back to the house and see if I could help. Because what I knew for sure was that I could feel and see a little boy who a long time ago had drowned in the stream behind the house. He hadn't died in the stream. Instead, he'd been carried into the house, and then his spirit left his body in that bedroom. And the house is for sale now. So I thought, okay, I can ask for showing, and I can go and get a sense. But what I've noticed is that every time I even turn my body, I can stand in my bedroom and turn my body in the direction of that house, and I immediately lose my ability to breathe. My chest gets heavy and sore, and I can't breathe. And I'm filled with a feeling of fear and dread that is not normal for me around beings who have passed away. Generally, it's a very loving and supportive and comforting experience. I'm able to help other people to heal their hearts and their grief. But with this particular entity or that home, it crushes me and it feels dangerous. So I have made a decision that rather than move toward that entity and try to solve the problem, I'm just going to do what feels right for me and stay away. That's my story.
So if anybody's looking at real estate in Bucksport, I want to talk to Naomi first. And speaking of haunted houses, our next storyteller is Tabletop Joe Fisher. You'll also maybe recognize his voice. He's one of the hosts of Departure on WERU on Friday nights. He's also an organic farmer from Winterport, Maine, and I did not know this, although I've been at this house several times. I wish I'd been told that his house is supposedly haunted by the spirit, the ghost of a murderer, although he has never seen her. Joe and I also, several years ago, rode along with a crew from Bangor that did ghost hunting, and we did a we did a report for Voices on that, which is, I'm sure, still available in the archive somewhere, too, but we went out in cemeteries with those little, like, clicker things, and it was pretty cool. So his story tonight is called The Ghost of Black's Woods, and a little bit about it. The stretch of Route 182 between Franklin and Cherryfield is a beautiful but eerie place, haunted by the ghost of a young woman who died in an accident. There are many versions of this story, but they all share the same elements: a foggy night, a wrecked vehicle, a missing man, a woman without a head asking for help. Refuse her at your own risk, and the curse will fall on you. Joe Fisher, come on up.
Stop me if you've heard this one. A young man is out driving on a beautiful late spring night when he happens to see a person at the side of the road, a girl wearing a prom dress. She's hitchhiking. Oh, good, you have heard it. He pulls over and rolls down the window. She's very embarrassed, but her car is broken down, or she's run out of gas, or possibly her date has just ditched her at the side of the road, and who'd he mind terribly giving her a ride home? He wouldn't mind. He opens the door and she gets in. After a few minutes, she begins to complain about being cold. After all, she's been trying to flag someone down for the past half hour. Being a gallant type, he lends her the coat he's wearing, despite it being his prized letter jacket. When they arrive at her home, she thanks him, smiles, and disappears into the house. It's only the next day that he realizes that he forgot to collect his jacket. He drives back to the house and knocks at the door. A middle-aged woman, who bears a marked resemblance to the girl, opens the door. Clearly, her mother. "Excuse me, ma'am," he said, for he was sometimes a well-brought-up letterman. "I dropped your daughter off here last night, and I think she still has my jacket." The woman looked surprised and sad. "No, no, you didn't," she said. "My daughter died in a car crash coming home from the prom many years ago. But I can tell you where to find your jacket." So he drove to the local cemetery, and there it was, folded neatly on the girl's gravestone. As it turns out, Maine has its share of phantom hitchhikers. The Haynesville Woods, that stretch of road that's never, ever, ever seen a smile, is apparently crawling with them. But none is so eerie, so creepy, so inexplicable as the one I mean to tell tonight, the story of Catherine, the ghost of Black's Woods. Black's Woods Road is a section of Route 182, as pretty and treacherous a drive as you're likely to encounter. It's full of hairpin turns and switchbacks, sudden drop-offs and frost heaves, eroding overhangs and massive boulders left behind by the glacier, not to mention a surprising number of drivers who can't, or won't, obey the speed limit. Not to blame them, it's not the kind of place a person wants to hang around too long, especially not in the snow, or the rain, or the fog. Catherine is said to have died in an accident while returning home from a dance, or her wedding, on a foggy night. The driver, her husband or boyfriend, lost control of the vehicle and they crashed into a tree, or a boulder, or perhaps into Fox Pond, at the bottom of which there's a perfectly preserved Model T Ford. However it happened, the young couple were killed instantly. Catherine was thrown through the windshield, severing her head. Her companion's body was never found, except in one version, where he was discovered weeping and holding her head in his lap. The story goes that on nights when the fog creeps in, so cold, so blinding, and so moist, when the moonlight is thin and untrustworthy, on nights like that, the ghost of Catherine can be seen, standing at the top of the hill that bears her name. Usually, she stands by the roadside and tries to flag down a ride. Other times, she stands in the middle of the road, looking as solid and human as you or me, until the car passes through her. Once, an unlucky traveling salesman, which tells you how old this story is, saw Catherine standing in her usual spot, wearing her usual white dress, but missing her head. Instead of stopping, he sped down the road in horror and disbelief. He was relieved to have escaped so easily, until he felt a presence in the car with him, and glancing in the rearview mirror, saw Catherine's headless figure in the back seat. He lost control of the car, smashing into the nearest tree, dying instantly. Dale Whitney, a local jazz musician and car dealer who played tenor saxophone in dozens of bands throughout the 50s and 60s, told the tale of his encounter with Catherine to his son, David. He was returning home to Machias from a gig in Bar Harbor late one night when he saw the figure of a young woman in a white gown standing by the side of the road, trying to flag him down. He stopped the car and wheeled down the window, but just a crack. She said that she needed a ride to Bar Harbor. He was considering this when the girl's face became suddenly transparent, and he could see the white line in the road through it. In a panic, he managed to blurt out, "But I just came from there," before speeding away. When he came to the foot of Catherine's Hill, he had recovered and began to wonder if his eyes had played tricks on him. Worried about the girl he just abandoned at the top of the hill, he turned the car around and returned to the place where she had been. Seeing no one there, he called out and searched for her, but found nothing. The following day, Dale had business to attend to in Ellsworth, so he drove through Black's Woods again. This time it was beautiful and sunny, surely not haunted. But when he came to the top of Catherine's Hill, he saw a sight that changed his mind forever. A van lay totaled at the side of the road, wrecked so badly that nobody could have lived through it, at the very spot where he'd seen the ghost.
Thank you, Joe.
And up next, another one of our regulars here, Amy Rader. Amy's the executive director of the 1932 Criterion Theater, and she listens to murder podcasts on her commute. She'll be telling stories about theater ghosts, specifically the ghost in her undergrad theater, one at the Penobscot Theater Company that she saw herself, and one at the Criterion Theater. Welcome back, Amy Rader.
As a caveat, and in the interest of time, I have eliminated my undergrad ghost story. Ask me in the lobby later. When I'm telling stories at a WERU event, you can be sure I'll either mention summer camp or theater, sometimes both. And while my favorite summer camp is Wicked Haunted, I'm going to talk about theater ghosts that I know. Theaters have long been some of the most haunted places in our world, and my theory about theater ghosts in general is that an actor will take stage time whenever, wherever, and in whatever state of existence they can. In fact, in every new theater that I work in, I will look around at some point and think to myself, well, is this the place that I want to haunt after I die? When I started at Penobscot Theater in Bangor, one of the first things I did was to meet with the teenagers who had been through the educational programs at the theater. I wanted to meet them and talk with them and see how they could possibly be more involved at the theater, which is usually code for, we need cheap labor backstage. Before we had even been properly introduced, one of them looked right at me and said, "You know about the ghosts, don't you?" The meeting took a hard left turn as they told me all about the little girl ghost who either rolls a ball down the dead-end staircase of house left or plays pranks with costumes in the dressing rooms. She ties sleeves together. She moves costume pieces into the wrong dressing room. She eats your food. One teen looked me dead in the eyes and said, "I left a cookie on my dressing room table, and when I came back, it was gone." I felt like maybe I should have pointed out that she did plays with elementary schoolers in an old building, and if there's anything with less impulse control than a third grader, it's an opera house rat. But sure, a ghost ate your cookie, honey. I didn't meet the little girl ghost, though. I met someone else. I should start by saying that I am not capable of functioning in scary or spooky situations. For an example, when I lost my control of my car on black ice when I was younger, the first thing I did was remove my hands from the steering wheel and place them over my face. Because my brain said to me, if you can't see it, it's not happening. I'm convinced that if a burglar broke into my house, I would probably put a blanket over my head in lieu of calling 911. So one May evening, I was in a performance of August Osage County, which featured a three-story skeleton of a house on stage. I had just done a scene with the woman who played my mother, and by the way, her name is Danielle Kennedy. She was on Narcos. She is one of the greatest actors and human beings I know. I love her. I'm fully sending this story to her later to get brownie points. But we had done the scene. We exited upstage, up the stairs to her bedroom area. And as I sat there waiting for our next entrance, I looked out. The audience was below us, and the balcony was right in my line of sight. Now, the balcony at Penobscot Theater Company is not used for seating anymore, and nobody was supposed to be up there. Much to my surprise, I saw a figure dressed entirely in black sitting in the shadows of the far right balcony, sitting with its back against the wall and legs parallel to the balcony railing. My brain said, "You didn't see that." I looked away. But when I looked back, the figure was still there, and I couldn't see its face. It was like a black void where the face should be. "Nope, nope, you're not seeing anything, Amy. Nothing there. Turn away." And I listened to my brain, and I just went about the business of doing the play. About 2 hours after I got home, though, my brain got back in touch and said, "Amy, yeah, we were lying. You saw that." And I have maintained a baseline of abject terror every time I walk into that building since. But now, I work at the 1932 Criterion Theater in Bar Harbor. Sidebar, sometimes when I say, "Welcome to the 1932 Criterion Theater," people will follow up by saying, "When was the theater built?"
1967. From the get-go, I knew that that theater was super haunted, like next-level haunted. But again, I cannot function in scary or spooky circumstances. So one of the hazards of the job is having to duck past ghost tour groups on the way to the restroom. I'd see my wonderful tour guide friend Jennifer in the lobby, surrounded by a gang of folks hanging on her every word, and I'd jam my fingers in my ears and la 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 all the way to the restroom and back. But one day I decided to rip the Band-Aid off, and I walked into the theater and I looked Jennifer in the eye and said, "Tell me about the ghosts." Well, the Criterion was built in 1932 by George MacKay, who wanted to bring the finest in live entertainment and cinema to his beloved community of Bar Harbor. But he also wanted a place for his beloved community to get hammered because he was a bootlegger. The Criterion was built with a speakeasy in the basement, and that is either the most elaborate cover for an illegal bar or the most Byzantine reason for a theater to exist, but either way, I love it. And you can see the theater's dual function in a lot of the architectural elements. Instead of one box office window that's centrally located, we have one on either side of the entrance so that each box office person could watch a different end of Cottage Street for the cops. George MacKay installed the state-of-the-art intercom system in the building, and the lobby intercom has 8 channels, each one of them labeled, one for calling backstage, one for the orchestra pit, one for the box office, one for the projection booth, one for front of house, and 3 unlabeled channels that very likely ran to the speakeasy. But if the cops somehow slipped by all the watchful eyes and raided the theater, there was an escape route. All the drunks had to do was walk down a short hallway, bang a left at the furnace, and keep following a subterranean tunnel until they came out right down by the waterfront. I was told that the cops didn't chase people down the tunnel. They'd just stand at the top of the street on a hill and write down the names of everybody they recognized as they popped out of the exit, and then they paid them a visit the next day. The speakeasy is still there. It's now the green room where all of the performers rest when they're not on stage, and the tunnel still exists, though now it dead ends in the basement of another business on Cottage Street. But George MacKay wasn't just a dashing bad boy bootlegger, and man, if I was alive in 1932, I probably would have dated him because how awesome. But he also looked out for his own. George had a nephew who was also named George who came back from World War II with shell shock, which we now know is post-traumatic stress disorder. Younger George was having a terrible time of reintegrating back into society. He couldn't hold a job. He didn't have a place to live. He drank real, real hard. Elder George saw his nephew's troubles and said, "Hey, tell you what, how do you feel about running a theater?" So George the younger took over the theater's management and even lived at the theater. By all accounts, young George was doing okay for himself for a couple of years. Unfortunately, George was still drinking hard. One night, he was drinking in dressing room number 2, which is where he lived and slept, and he passed out with a lit cigarette in his hand. The cigarette fell on the horsehair mattress, and George died of smoke inhalation before the firemen could rescue him. Sidebar, how bad would it smell for burning horsehair? I mean, ugh. So it's a sad story that he passed away, but George has not left the building. In fact, George has been seen so many times around the theater by so many people, I should probably have him on payroll. He's most frequently seen running through the balcony, passing through the walls between the loge boxes, or sitting in loge box A, his favorite in life and in death. He's also been seen casually walking down the house left aisle, up the stairs to the stage, and through the curtain. George can also be heard and occasionally felt. He's been known to knock on the stage or the walls, and I've heard that if you give him shaving a haircut, he'll come back at you with 2 bits. But he seems to take most delight in reaching out and touching someone. My production manager, the guy that keeps the theater running, who fixes everything, is a wonderful man named Chuck. He's the most chill human alive. His motto for the Criterion and in his life is, "If you can't be groovy, you can't be here." I love him. But about a month ago, Chuck was 30 feet in the air on a ladder fixing a light when he felt a very distinct and insistent tap on his shoulder. Without missing a beat, Chuck said, "Oh, "Hey, man," and continued his work. Now, the next thing is the thing that keeps me up nights, the thing that would fully override my brain's coping mechanisms and likely damage me forever if it happened to me. One time, a woman was sitting in a seat in the orchestra listening to a ghost tour guide when some kid scooted under her chair and grabbed at her ankles. She got annoyed. She kicked the kid's hands away. Pretty soon it happened again, and she looked down, prepared to yell at the kid, but there was no one there, and there never had been. I can think of nothing so terrifying as an ankle-grabbing ghost, and that's one of the reasons I almost never sit down during a show. I pace in the back, but if I do have to sit, I sit cross-legged or just hold my legs up the whole time, which I think some of you are probably doing right now. But part of the reason that I am here telling you all of this is because I want you to remember me as I am, slightly attractive, mildly sane, and in possession of most of my faculties, because this Saturday, we are having a 4-hour ghost hunt from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., and I volunteered to be on staff that night. I cannot cope in spooky situations, so it is conceivable that I will die of fright or stumble into the bright light of Sunday morning, a gibbering white-haired mess incapable of saying anything other than ankles. But if I somehow make it through the evening unscathed, I'll be sure to let George know that all of you send your best. Postscript. We also have a female ghost who likes to show up without a head, but I won't talk about her because she scares the shit out of me.
Thanks, Amy. Another new to our stage storyteller is Lynn Susie. She's up next. She says she is a longtime WERU hanger honor, but we're not going to let her get away with that because she's actually a very active volunteer who serves on the WERU board. She is going to tell an old family story about her uncle, Om, in which a young boy dies tragically, but continues to come back to his home and his bedroom, visit with his siblings and other children who lived in that house for decades. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you, Amy. Much of this story was told to me by my Uncle George, then a sensible, serious, middle-aged man, not given to fancy. In the summer of 1923, in a tiny town about 200 miles north of here on the Maine-New Brunswick border, a couple named Josephine and Warren had three children. They had a 4-year-old girl, a 2.5-year-old boy, and an infant daughter. The boy was named Warren after his father, but his 4-year-old sister couldn't say Warren. She called her brother Om. That was as close as she could come. So cute. The parents may have enunciated the name clearly, but the neighbors and the shopkeeper and the priest thought the name the girl had given her brother was so cute, Om, that they often called him Om. In a tragic accident, Om died. In the shock and pain and confusion that followed, he was buried quickly in a cemetery of the church which his mother attended, but no marker was erected. Perhaps sometime later, a small white wooden cross was put up, but over decades it decayed and disappeared. His father was so grieved by the loss of this boy that he never mentioned him again. And his mother, knowing that her husband was so pained by the memory, she also never mentioned the boy again. The only person who spoke of him couldn't pronounce his name. His sister would say, "Where's Om? When will Om come home? Can Om come play?" Until eventually she stopped asking about him. Well, time goes on, and Josephine and Warren had two other children. If the youngest three children ever heard about the lost boy, it would have been from the oldest sister whispering about her brother Om. The children grew up, became adults, and moved away. Warren died about 1947, and was buried in the cemetery of a church of the other church in this tiny town, about a mile from the resting place of the boy. Shortly after that, Josephine sold the family home to a local couple named Geraldine and Earl, who were just starting their family. Geraldine moved to be closer to her daughters. Time continued to go on. Josephine died, and she was buried back in the hometown next to her husband, and a stone was put up over their graves with their names and dates. Sometime after that, their other son, George, thinking about the brother he'd never known, thought perhaps he should have that boy's name and dates engraved on the parent's stone. So he made a trip to the cemetery to ascertain that there would be room on this stone. And when he determined that there was, he made a little trip around his old hometown, going by his childhood home. There on the lawn, raking her leaves, was Geraldine, the woman who had bought the house from his mother. They were acquainted, so George stopped for a chat. During the course of the conversation, he told Geraldine what he was about and that he planned to have his brother's name engraved on his parents' stone. Geraldine, herself a serious, sensible, middle-aged woman, said, "That's good. That may put the boy to rest." "What? What do you mean, put the boy to rest?" Geraldine explained that while her children were growing up, they often reported a small boy would come into their room at night. They would awake at night and find a boy that they did not know standing by the end of their beds. Sometimes he would sit on the bed. He would smile at them. Sometimes he would gesture to them to come and play. Even if they couldn't go and play with him, he seemed happy to be with them. He would smile, he would watch them. Geraldine herself was very accepting of this story, and she told her children that this was a little boy who used to live in their house, whose name was Om. The children noticed that Om came quite often late at night, just before daylight, actually. They also noticed that he would come when they were sick, when they weren't feeling well. He would pat the bed, and they would be better in the morning. Geraldine's husband, Earl, thought this was childhood foolishness and didn't like to hear it. One time, Earl decided that there needed to be a closet in one of the bedrooms of his children, so he got the tools and decided he could build a closet. He was busily hammering when he got that prickly sensation in the back of the neck that you get when you know there's someone watching you. He turned around, saw a small boy in a long nightdress. He dropped his hammer, ran from the room, never went back, and the closet remained unfinished. This family of children grew up, and when the next generation came along to visit their grandmother, they often reported visits from the boy as well. He would stand by their bed or sit on their bed, smile and watch them. None of the children in either generation ever expressed any fear. There was no reason to fear this sweet little boy. George hastened to, as proof of all this, Geraldine offered to show George the yet unfinished closet. George hastened to have his brother's name and dates engraved on the stone, and he stayed in touch with Geraldine. He went back to see her several times. Over a number of years, reports of Om's appearance decreased, but it did not cease completely. Perhaps there were visits were reduced because there were fewer children in that house. There are no reports of George visiting his siblings, but does that mean he didn't do it? I'm sorry. There were no reports of Om visiting his siblings. But does that mean he didn't come? This family grew up without speaking. They lived without speaking of the lost boy. Perhaps he did come visit. Perhaps the older sister who was taught not to speak of him. And perhaps he visited and she didn't speak of it. Now all of his siblings have gone on to play with Om. The house passed to another family. Later, a fire destroyed it. There have been no sightings of Om for more than a decade. But does this mean he is at rest? Does it mean there are no children there for him to visit? Or is it because the house is gone? Or is it because nobody speaks of it?
Thank you, Lynn. That was great. All right, so our last storyteller is in place. How does an atheist tell a ghost story and make it believable? Returning storyteller David Wieda will provide his atheist definition of ghost and share a story from his past about a family of ghosts who will haunt him forever. You're up.
Zombie piping. I'm not here for your brains, I'm here for your hearts. Thank you very much. When Amy approached me about telling a ghost story this evening, I was inclined to say no. I didn't immediately have my head wrapped around the idea that I could tell a ghost story, since I'm an atheist and I don't really believe in ghosts. Then, after I thought about it for a very short time, I realized that I feel very haunted by so many interesting and important people from my history. These are my ghosts. And I certainly have some stories to tell about how they continue to haunt me. I tend to give my attention to the good ghosts who have had a positive impact on my life and continue to haunt me for many years following our initial contact. Here goes. In the spring of 1977, near the end of my senior year in high school in Leavenworth, Kansas, my friend Dan and I pulled off a prank that we had been contemplating for nearly 2 years. Dan and I were part of a great group of friends. We called ourselves the Mob. We were a nice collection of band kids, theater kids, and creative, smart kids. We were mutually supportive. There was no bullying. And our joyful gatherings often took place on a Friday night in the playground of a local park. We were imaginative, so we frequently came up with silly pranks that weren't really dangerous, but often edgy and sometimes hilarious. A few blocks from our high school campus, there was a small church that boasted a sign in the front yard, which had the standard removable letters that slid on and off, allowing for efficient changing out of the weekly message. The notion of changing the message on that sign had been suggested many times by Dan and me and a few others in the Mob, but it just never seemed to develop into a doable prank. I was a senior and Dan was a junior. Our two overlapping years at Leavenworth High School had been our opportunity to form a wonderful friendship that would become lifelong. We both played trumpet and were always competing for first chair in the band's trumpet section. I was also a singer. Following my graduation in a few weeks, I would be readying to start my college work as a music major at Emporia State University, a 2.5-hour drive from Leavenworth. Both Dan and I had competed as soloists in the state music festival in early May, and we both had received number one ratings, a joyful way to complete our school year. The following weekend would be one of the final times to go out and have some fun with the Mob. On Friday, Dan made the suggestion that perhaps we would finally change out the message on the church sign. Let's do this before you graduate and run away. He also suggested that it would be a fitting prank to celebrate our success at the state music festival the previous weekend. We took advantage of the open lunch hour at Leavenworth High and headed to the A&W, on a route that would take us past the church, so we could write down the messages on the two-sided sign, thus knowing what our inventory of letters would be for our creation of our message. One side read, "The bitter is sweet when you kneel at his feet." And the other side simply read, "Come and worship with us." Back at school after lunch, Dan and I each spent our remaining class periods playing anagrams with the two messages, developing words to fit together in a creative and meaningful new message that would be worthy of our efforts to pull off this prank. We reconnected at the end of the school day and presented our newly created messages for mutual evaluation. Dan had developed the winner, we both agreed, and we were ready to do this the next night. Our hope was that by changing the sign on a Saturday night, maybe, just maybe, the church folks wouldn't notice the change and parishioners would arrive for the church service on Sunday morning greeted by our creative work. The next evening, Saturday, was a dark and balmy night. A beautiful spring night in our sweet little town. The perfect night for us to pull off this prank that would confirm our status as heroes within the mob and create a memory that would haunt us for the rest of our lives. We started the night with pizza and root beer at the Pizza Hut, our usual dinner of choice for our weekend outings. Then we headed over to the church around 9:30 p.m. I was driving my 1974 green Gremlin. Yes, that's true. I parked parallel right near the sign, and Dan and I quickly jumped out and slid all of the letters off of the tracks and into a paper bag. Step one had just gone off without a hitch. Step two would require us to find a remote, secluded place to park and reorder the letters into our new message in preparation for easy and efficient application when we returned to the sign. We decided to drive up to Westwood Drive on Pilot Knob, Leavenworth's biggest hill, just behind the high school campus and close to the church. It was a wooded and quiet residential street. We pulled off to the side of the road, away from the light of the nearest street lamp. Dan and I pulled all the letters out of the bag and spread them out on the seat and began forming the new words for our new message. We were working effectively and quickly. He would call out the next needed letter, and I would shuffle through the pile of letters and hand it off to him. We weren't quite finished when, suddenly, a police car with flashing lights pulled up right behind us. We scrambled and quickly jammed all of the letters underneath our car seats. They were stolen property, and we knew we had to hide them. We had both assumed our innocent, cool-as-a-cucumber persona as the cop approached my driver's side window with his high-beam flashlight shining into the car. "What are you guys up to tonight?" he asked us. Now remember, this is Leavenworth, Kansas in 1977. We are two high school boys parked off the dark, woodsy road on Pilot Knob at 10:30 on a beautiful spring Saturday night. I offered the best answer I could come up with given the circumstances. "We're just shooting the breeze, officer." He asked us our names and asked us if we had any alcohol in the car. I wish I would have said, "Go find your own alcohol." As it turned out, he knew Dan and chose not to give us any more anxiety. He turned the beam of his flashlight away from our faces and said, "Well, don't stay out too late and be careful, guys," as he walked back to his patrol car, then drove away. Okay, so step two had a little bit of a hitch, but we made it through and quickly finished the task of reordering the letters, then drove the few blocks back to the church. We worked silently and quickly under the light of the moon, probably accompanied by the sound of hooting owls, howling wolves, and the nearly silent wing beats of circling bats. And we did it. Mission accomplished. The next morning, I had to work early at my neighborhood grocery store. I drove away from home in time to stop over at the church to see our handiwork from the night before. There it was, in the spring morning sunlight for all to see, a big sign with a clear message for everyone of any religious persuasion. What had originally read, "The bitter is sweet when you kneel at his feet," and "Come and worship with us," now stated so beautifully, "Come with sweaty feet, worship clean shoes." Absolutely beautiful, huh? I went to work at the grocery store and called Dan. It's still up, and it looks great. We congratulated each other and laughed and laughed and laughed. Amazingly, the church apparently liked the new message. They kept it in place the entire week. Perhaps they took it as a lovely metaphor, pronouncing that all are welcome into the beauty of their worshiping. Or perhaps the church staff never even noticed the change, complacent and comfortable in the presumption that their sign had been updated earlier in the week and all was well with the world. If that's the case, I love the fact that the parishioners must have read our message and accepted it as the gospel truth. All good ghost stories have a bit of truth, right? Dan and I had pulled off the church sign prank, and that night would be remembered and talked about many times over the next many years of our amazing lifelong friendship. I will be joyfully haunted by this story forever, and haunted by my wonderful friend Dan Needham for the rest of my days. Just last Friday night, October 19th, 2018, another of my high school friends and a member of the mob called to tell me that Dan had died of a heart attack at 5:30 that evening. His wonderful wife, Mary, and his two remarkable children, who sometimes call me Uncle David, know that I am telling this ghost story tonight. While in Kansas City, they are gathering for the wake at their church, where Dan had been the much beloved and effective director of social services outreach. I wrote a brief remembrance about my friendship with Dan, and Mary will have someone read it tonight in my absence. This is what I wrote. I'm cherishing the countless memories and beautiful, relevant life lessons I learned during the past 43 years of friendship with Dan Needham. Leavenworth High School, 1975, we picked each other out of the crowd. Music and appropriate teenage angst brought us together, along with cynical optimism and joyful empathy. Big hearts, big dreams, thoughtful conversations, and silliness with great comic timing created our enduring friendship, which sent us into adulthood with a deep desire to live full lives, understanding the importance of engaging with our loved ones, our neighbors, and our community. He remained my wonderful friend throughout these fleeting years. He shared his wonderful family with me, and I felt that loving support throughout my life. He always understood and supported my social and political activism. In private conversations, he encouraged and emboldened me, always shoring up my self-esteem and affirming his love and respect. I will feel his absence for the rest of my days, and he will continue to impact my life and the choices I hope I will make based on thoughtful compassion, rational observation, and remembering that we each can make a difference in this world that needs our love and tender care, along with our creative energy, laughter, joyfulness, and music. I love Mary Oliver's poem, The Summer Day. Here's how she ends it. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? My heart is full as I revel in the sweet memories and abundant joyful love that Dan gave all of us as he lived out his one wild and precious life. So that is my atheist ghost story for tonight. I don't have to worry about Dan becoming a zombie or having to wander through the flames of hell or the damp clouds of heaven. And I will joyfully accommodate his ghost in what remains of my one wild and precious life. My only regret tonight is that I do not have the crew lined up to put an appropriate message on the sign in front of the church in Kansas City prior to Dan's funeral service tomorrow. I really think he would have approved if it could read, "Come with sweaty feet, worship clean shoes." Thanks for listening, and choose your ghosts wisely, and you will never be afraid of them. Good night.
Thank you, David. Can we have another round of applause for all these great storytellers tonight? And before you all escape, I want all the storytellers to come up for a photograph before you all take off.
That's it for tonight. Thank you all for coming out. There are a lot of other things going on tonight in the community, so we appreciate that you came and spent some time with us. If you're interested in local storytelling, we have a section on the WERU archives that is called Maine Stories that has several years' worth of different storytelling programs that we've recorded. So you can go there and check it out. And if you yourself are a storyteller or would like to be, get in touch with me because we'll keep doing these different themes and we're always looking for more storytellers, so amy@weru.org. So thank you to Paula Key, thank you to the Alamo Theater, thank you to Susan Pierce, and to Matt Murphy from WERU for helping set this up, and thank you to all of you for coming out tonight.